From The Recount, I'm Rena Ninen, and you're listening to The Recount Daily Pod. Today is Thursday, August 26th.
We cannot lose the voices of 19 million women who are going to be fighting for themselves, whether the world pays attention or not.
That was Gail Samak-Lamone, adjunct senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of The Dressmaker. Gail joined me earlier to speak on the critical topic of the fate of women and girls under Taliban rule. We'll dig into that a little bit later on in the show, but first, your morning headlines. We begin with COVID. 2 days after the FDA approved the Pfizer vaccine, Moderna announced that they have now submitted their application to health officials. The vaccine maker hopes to have the FDA's stamp of approval before the end of September, when Pfizer and Moderna boosters will be made available. Johnson & Johnson has yet to file its application, but hopes to by the end of the year. The CDC has held off on making recommendations for a Johnson & Johnson booster as it awaits more data. Meanwhile, the vaccine mandates keep rolling in. The NFL sent a memo to all 32 teams saying that only fully vaccinated staff would be allowed to enter the locker room on game days. The memo also said that media would no longer be allowed into their locker rooms and would instead need to interview players at press events. For new city and state mandates, the city of Chicago joins other larger cities in announcing that all its employees must be fully vaccinated by October 15th. Half of all Florida's public schools are now officially defying the governor by issuing mask mandates for all students and staff. And finally, Oregon became the first state to bring back outdoor mask mandates for both vaccinated and unvaccinated people because of the sharp rise in cases. After a fierce user backlash, social media website OnlyFans has reversed course on its planned porn ban and will instead continue to offer sexually explicit content. The subscription-based site had originally announced the ban in response to a pressure campaign waged by banking partners critical of the site's business model. With new assurances from payment processors, the site's 120 million registered users can now go back to purchasing porn. Over 1 million content creators earn money on the site, which brings in big bucks for some. The top earner generates an estimated $20 million a month. With less than a week to go on President Joe Biden's Afghanistan withdrawal deadline, Pentagon spokesman John Kirby announced the creation of several contingency plans if more time was needed. Kirby went on to share that the military had nonetheless made significant progress with evacuations, with over 19,200 people airlifted in a 24-hour period. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said that he estimates less than 1,000 U.S. citizens remain in Afghanistan. That number does not include legal permanent residents or green card holders. According to Al Jazeera, tens of thousands of Afghans who qualify for special immigration visas are still waiting to be evacuated. An internal UN report exclusively seen by Reuters documents the violence towards an Afghan UN officer who was stopped on his way to Kabul airport. His vehicle was then searched when his UN ID was found. He was beaten. On Monday, three unknown men visited the home of another UN staffer who was at work at the time. The men threatened the worker's son and accused him of lying about who his father works for, saying, quote, "We know his location and what he does." The report contained more than a dozen other incidents. The issue of how the Taliban intends to treat women and girls under its rule has also garnered international attention and scrutiny. A generation of women and girls have grown up with liberties and rights unimaginable under the previous Taliban regime. The new regime claims that they will respect women's rights. But will they? We dig into this in today's Daily Deep Dive. Gail Samak-Lamone, adjunct senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of The Dressmaker, joins us to lay out the stakes. Gail, welcome.
Glad to be here.
I want to ask you right now, you know, you have been following the situation in Afghanistan, traveling there. What are you hearing on the ground?
My first trip, what I learned really is that everything is much more complex when you're on the ground. You know, there's a whole generation of girls that grew up with the international presence and also grew up with conflict. And they are connected. Their lives look different, but their hopes look a lot like those of the young women in your family. And I think we're all waiting to see what comes next as the Taliban takes power.
You mentioned as the Taliban takes power in their first press conference, they said they would respect women's rights. Do you believe them?
It depends on whose interpretation of women's rights. And I think we don't know It's easy to say that we will respect women's rights. It's harder to say what will that look like on the ground. And let's start with freedom of mobility, which right now women cannot exercise, right? They cannot move around and leave the country if they wish, you know. So we will see. It's true that the Taliban was never a monolith. The first book I wrote is Dressmaker of Karkana. Was about a teenager whose business supported her family under the Taliban. So there were young women who were worked underground, who supported families all around their communities, but it was very difficult. And the rules were, you know, no going out without a chaperone, no high heels on the street, no laughing in public, you know, women should not be heard, must wear the burqa. So all of these were very much in place. The biggest thing, of course, was no girls' education. So we'll see, right? We will see if Taliban 2021 is evolved significantly from the way that they've ruled other cities that they've taken since 2001.
The book that you wrote looked at entrepreneurship, female entrepreneurship. And in that, you chronicled the stories of a prominent women's rights activist who became an entrepreneur, former government minister, inspired dozens of women to take advantage of economic freedoms their mothers didn't get. Have you been in touch with Kamala since the Taliban takeover? What does she think of the future?
Sure. I mean, I think she's like everybody else, you know, fearful, but also waiting to see. And I don't mean just fearful of Taliban, fearful of all the uncertainty that war has brought and that the next phase will bring. But I think she's very committed to her country. You know, she was very clear, and the book is very clear, that she followed the rules of the Taliban last time around. They didn't have men come to the house. You know, they only worked with women. They were indoors. All of these things, you know, that's why the dressmaking business really managed to maneuver in this space, right? And the Taliban was never a monolith. They sent some of their daughters to sew and to work with Kamala.
Wow,
at
really?
That time. And the book really talks about that. The young woman says, my father knows you're honorable. We need the income. And he knows you're not working with men. So I think we're going to have to see. I am not at all saying it's going to be good for women. I want to be very clear. But what I'm saying is we have to see what space for maneuver. Though international pressure can help create, but most importantly, women are going to create for themselves.
Mm. Women are going to create for themselves. That's the message I keep hearing with your work and what you've put out there. Yeah. When you talk about the international community's involvement, I mean, $787 million to support programs, Human Rights Watch, other groups over the past 20 years. Do you think there will be more investment poured in to help these women?
You know, everybody's on the sidelines waiting to see it. There are some NGOs who worked with the Taliban last time that are, they say they are committed to trying to stay in the country. And there's no question the Taliban will want them to. These are not people who know how to run a government, know how to run a banking system, know how to run an electricity grid, know how to build trade agreements, right? This is not what they do. So they might have technical vehicles, but they don't have technocrats. And they told a friend of mine in recent negotiations, you know, we need your engineers, we need your doctors. And what kind of the values are this going to stand behind? You know, I think we are going to have to see, because the world does have pressure to bear on what comes next.
So if women and girls don't abide by the Taliban rules and they're shut out from society, how do you think that'll affect Taliban rule?
Here's the reality. Women will go forward no matter what. But they are our greatest ally for security, stability, and peace, even if we really rarely treat them that way. So they will continue to be the people who fight for a better future. They will continue to figure out how to support their families. They'll continue to figure out how to educate their children. And the question now is, will the Taliban suffocate that? Will it shove it underground? Will it fail to take advantage of half the population? Or is there some way? But the question is always, you know, people say, well, the Taliban still have rights. You know, for whom? I mean, you always have to ask for whom. And I think it's very important that we don't see women and girls as simply collateral damage, but that we continue to see them and how we can engage with them no matter what comes in Afghanistan to make sure that they achieve as much as they possibly can in order to contribute to an economy that needs them.
When you look at sort of the rhetoric coming out right now, Taliban spokesperson said, women, do not come out of your homes because these fighters are not prepared yet to deal with women. What ran through your mind when you heard that?
I mean, it's 1996, right? The first thing the Taliban said was this, you know, the last time around. If you think about Kabul as a really complex, very modern city and of millions of people, and the Taliban, many of them have never been in a city like that. They have no idea how the city works. They certainly don't know how to run one, but they do know that they need to establish law and order in their view. So they say they're not ready for women, even though it's women's city. So I think we're going to see how these worlds, the modern world that the international community engaged with for two decades in Afghanistan, right? So these women who stood alongside the U.S., stood alongside NATO. Now we're going to see what happens when that world of scholarship and study and travel abroad collides with a Taliban reality that is not 2021. So all those worlds colliding is what we are about to see. And we're about to see women's lives be a battlefield yet again.
I noticed you wrote on your Twitter feed this week, you said you researched your first book and you found notes from it, from Taliban first meeting with NGOs. This is back in 1996 when the group swept Kabul. Now comes 2021. Same discussions now lie ahead.
So the Taliban will be navigating. The Taliban will be trying to figure out the way ahead with wants international dollars. It wants international support. It wants international legitimacy. The cities, the places, the areas it has ruled have seen women's radio shut down, have seen women's mobility curtailed. What happens when Kabul meets Taliban 2021? That is what we're about to see, because the international community is going to have to decide how it engages. Whether it engages. 19 million girls, no matter how many people get out, will be left in the country.
We've got to take a quick break, but we'll be right back with Gail Samak-Lamone. Welcome back to The Recount Daily Pod, a podcast from The Recount and iHeartRadio. I'm joined by Gail Samak-Lamone from the Council on Foreign Relations and author of The Dressmaker. We're talking about the future of women and girls in Afghanistan under Taliban rule. The UN Secretary General said that there are some accounts of women being abused by the Taliban already, started to pour in. What can the international community do if there is incredible violence, if there is this destruction and hatred and violence towards women? What's the appropriate way for the international community to respond?
This is the question. What comes next? And how do we see young women navigate this world? First of all, I would just urge everybody watching to stay engaged. This is on us. All of these girls in the world who are trying so hard to achieve their potential, to become teachers, to become doctors, to become nurses, their struggle is our struggle, right? Everybody who wants a world that is more secure, more safe, more stable, more prosperous must be on their side, right? Now is the time to say, we stand with them. And, you know, whether that means, okay, Taliban wants assistance, let's talk about what that looks like and make sure that none of that happens without women being a part of the dialogue and a part of contributing to their country.
So would you characterize your mood as potentially hopeful with the Taliban, or do you feel like you know who they are and what they stand for?
I'm not hopeful, but I don't think that we can stand here and predict exactly what's going to happen either. And for the sake of 19 million girls and women who are in the country, I think it's important that we have a role in part in what comes next, the international community, the world. So I think that is very important to me. As you know, I could stand here and say, oh, it's going to be terrible, or oh, it's going to be great. The reality is that the international community must play a role in shaping and in contributing to what comes next. People keep saying they have no leverage. That is just not true. The Taliban needs doctors. The Taliban needs technocrats. The Taliban wants aid agencies to stay. All of this is going to be a very complex web for the world to navigate, but it must engage. And we cannot lose the voices of 19 million women who are going to be fighting for themselves, whether the world pays attention or not.
19 million women, women who have gone to universities, who have been educated, who are working in some of the highest levels of government before the Taliban took over recently. How do you think the Taliban can govern without these women? Do you think that they can?
Well, I think they're trying to figure that out. They keep talking about it. Of course, they think they can govern without women. But the question is, do they think it's in their interest to include women? I don't make predictions about what comes next. It's a very dynamic time. The Taliban has not had a track record of any kind of humane treatment toward half the population, but also we haven't seen them run a country since 2001. So I think this is a different world. It's 20 years later, and there's a whole generation of girls that is far more educated, far more connected than any previously. So those worlds are going to come up right against each other right now.
When the U.S. first entered Afghanistan, the economy was in absolute ruins, 2 decades of war there. And then a president of the Afghanistan Women Chamber of Commerce says that there are now 57,000 women-owned and run businesses, created something like 130,000 jobs. Women occupy a fifth of government jobs. Clearly, they're a vital part of the economy. What do you think the outlook is for the Afghan economy now? What gives you the most hope about women's ability to work or potentially own their own businesses?
What gives me hope is women. The superpower that women have is just getting on with it. And regardless of what they have to live with and under, women do that. The question mark for me is whether the international community steps up and actually recognizes women not as sort of pet projects or people on the side that they appease, but rather people who are central to what comes next in shaping the future stability and security of their country.
In a recent op-ed for the Washington Post, you included messages you had received from Afghan women. What are you hearing now?
I mean, there is a rush for the exits. There are people who stood with the U.S. and NATO who we need to get to safety. We've talked about that. The president has talked about that. But then what happens to genuinely 19 million people who have been left behind or who are going to remain in their country? What does Afghanistan look like when you have people ruling who have never maneuvered in a world with women active? And I think everybody is trying to work out exactly how to engage. And that I think actually includes the Taliban.
What would you say if the White House asked you, help us, what do we do right now?
There are so many conversations going on about to engage, to not engage, right? Feminist Majority Foundation was very active last time in making sure that the Taliban was not recognized back in 1996. There's also a set of questions about, can you engage? Is it better for women and girls? There was a young woman I met who was the family's breadwinner. And all of these young women who last time were on the Taliban were breadwinners who have never gotten credit for all the work they did. And this one young woman worked at a WASH program, sanitation, and she was talking about what it was like to be on the streets at that time as a girl, you know, just feeling like the whole city was full of ghosts. She couldn't move anywhere. She couldn't do anything. They'd taken away her dreams of university. They had taken away her dreams of education. All of that, everyone has to decide how much we're going to continue to invest in those young women. Will we continue to run programs? Will the world engage? What happens to all these young women who thought they were going to be university students and now are worried about becoming Taliban brides? This is what the next few weeks and few months are going to tell us.
We're going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back with Gail Semach-Lamone from the Council on Foreign Relations and author of The Dressmaker on the Recount Daily Pod. Hey, welcome back to the Recount Daily Pod, a podcast from the Recount and iHeartRadio. I'm here with Gail Semach-Lamone from the Council on Foreign Relations and author of The Dressmaker, talking about the future of women and girls in Afghanistan under Taliban rule. You know, it's amazing. With all your experience, you are not quick to make predictions. You are waiting to see what is going to happen. It shows your expertise of understanding how fluid the situation is. What can the average person do to help?
Yeah, I would say 3 things. One is speak up. You know, part of why we're here is because so few people thought people cared about this conflict. So I say, please let folks know that you're watching, that you want America to continue to be thinking through how it navigates and engages with Afghanistan, not just writing it off, because we have to be careful with all those lives of women and girls and making sure what we do, whether it is to engage or to not engage, creates more space for them. And the second piece is give to local organizations that are working on the ground. They need the investment. And then 3, look at the places that are going to work with those who've resettled. We need to keep making sure we pay attention to those who have resettled. And we should actually very much be careful of loosening the visa restrictions for those who are able to get out to make sure that women fit in them.
And what will you be watching in the coming weeks?
I'll be watching to see what the Taliban says versus what the Taliban does. Do news organizations continue to operate? What happens to the women who are left? Are they killed? Are they shot in the head? Are they allowed to go along with their lives? What happens to people who are advocates for girls' education? Do they find the Taliban receptive to thinking through girls' education, right? All of these things we're going to see play out in very real time and watch to see whether the more open within the Taliban leadership are actually able to engage and to make concessions to the women from Afghanistan that they're engaging with, and whether that dialogue continues.
If you had a private moment with President Biden, what would you tell him?
That women are your best partners for peace, security, and stability. And it is in the American national security interest to invest in them.
Gail, I want to thank you so much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to join you.
And now to the look ahead. Here's what else we're watching today. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett is in Washington meeting with President Joe Biden for the first time. The men will discuss critical issues related to regional and global security. Their meeting is anticipated to be a turning point for U.S.-Israeli relations, as both leaders have expressed a desire for a fresh start following 12 years in power for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. It's Women's Equality Day, a day to celebrate the passage of the 19th Amendment, giving women the right to vote in 1920. But not all women were granted the right to vote. Minority women had to wait decades in some cases for Native Americans. The right to vote didn't happen until 1924. For Asian Americans, 1952. And for Black women, 1965. Today and every day, we honor the women that came before us who pushed for a more equitable future. Have a great weekend, everyone. I'll see you back on Monday. This is the Recount Daily Pod, a podcast from The Recount and iHeartRadio. Our thanks to Gail Simak-Limon for being on the show. And if you like this episode, I hope you'll subscribe to The Recount Daily Pod and leave us a rating on the Apple Podcast app. I'm your host, Rena Ninen. Alexis Ramdow and Corey Wara engineered and produced this podcast. Ariella Martin also produced. Fonda Mwangi did the research, and our executive producer is Laura Beatty.